This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Jim Wheeler. Today is August 19th, 2003. It's about 8:33 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas again. And Mr. Wheeler, you are in Denton, Texas.
Denton, Texas, correct.
Yes. And let's pick up with your second tour, sir. Wanted to ask you about, does anything come to mind when you think about your second tour? We've talked about some of the specifics, but any incidents, any missions, is anything, what highlights in your mind your second tour?
Well, from the personal perspective of simply being able to command a rifle company, mm-hmm. that in itself was the essence of my second tour.
Mm-hmm.
Taking command in December of 1969 and again commanding until July of the next year, 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we've already talked to it. Certainly the official or formal excursion into Cambodia was a pretty good highlight of my tour there. That was just very unique and different.
Mm-hmm.
I think we finished off last time. That was that I had... been selected to do some ambush work north of Pleiku coming out of Cambodia.
Yes.
That in itself was a highlight because of the being handpicked kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And once we finished up and I think I crashed through that MP barrier, so to speak, and got my boys back home,
mm-hmm.
is about where we left off. From then on out, it was pretty much standard search and destroy. A lot of combat air assaults, you know, via helicopter, obviously, into primarily in Binh Dinh province, which was in proximity of Camp Radcliffe, which was the division base camp.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of mountainous terrain, a lot of mountain climbing, and not an overabundance of contact with the enemy.
Okay.
As such.
Okay. On March 27, 1970, you were in some action in which you later awarded the Soldier's Medal for Heroism. Could you tell me about what happened that day?
Well, that was what really happened is we were in literally what we call triple canopy jungle, so that when you're in that kind of a setting, there's just very little break between in the trees, so that when it comes time for a resupply, you really need, if you will, a hole in the canopy to be able to access or to drop a resupply, you know, sea rations, et cetera, into.
Yes, sir.
In this particular circumstance, the best I could do with that was literally on the side of a mountain. And so I was just, it's hard to describe fully, but I was literally holding on to the tree, so to speak, on the side of a mountain with my radio guy talking to the helicopters that were coming in to drop our supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And where the supplies were dropping were well below us, way into a ravine.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the only, if you will, hole around that we could access. And so I was talking the choppers in for resupply, and they were coming in and throwing out cases of soda and our sea rations and other resupply well above the tree line, which was well above us.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a hole there that I felt if a guy wanted to, they could literally bring a helicopter down in there. And it may be a little precarious, but at least from my perspective, it seemed like they could. I didn't ask for that, but what I did do on this one particular deal was a chopper, you know, would have had two or three come in and you know, I don't know the count, but out of a 24 case of sodas, if you will, probably 20 of them were getting busted as they hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were so high. So I simply asked this helicopter pilot if he would at least consider bringing his skids down to treetop level, which was still way above where I am.
Mm-hmm.
And the ravine way down below, so still a tremendous fall for whatever we're dropping in. So I simply asked that that he at least do that, come down to at least treetop level. Well, as I say, there was a hole there, I think large enough certainly for a chopper to descend through. And I don't really know. I don't know that I ever knew from him if he, I may have, but I just don't remember, if he literally chose to just descend down through the hole and down closer to the bottom of the ravine, which would have taken some pretty good piloting, but I thought could be done, or if he literally just went down to treetop level with the skids and lost power because what he did, he jacked his aircraft around and his tail boom hit a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so just, I mean, it's out in front of me, maybe 50 meters, if probably not even that, but he hit the tree with the tail boom, and needless to say, you know what happened then, and right before my eyes, with not only with the pilots on the bird and the and the gun guys, the M60 guys, but also, you know, my own guy, or two guys from two soldiers from my company that were in the rear working supply, because when I tried to ship back to the rear as best we could with the consideration of our given missions,
mm-hmm.
when a guy got really short, I tried to send them back to the rear,
mm-hmm.
for just a very short time to keep them out of harm's way, if you will. So my emotions were much involved, because I had either one or two of my own soldiers on the aircraft, and they were short timers, and all of a sudden I see this $250,000 aircraft falling right before my eyes,
mm-hmm.
just passing right in front of me as it fell to the floor of this ravine. And as soon as it hit, if not before, because I'm there on the side of this mountain, because I've got a secured area up above in the jungle part, but I mean, I'm on the side of the mountain here with my CP guys, three or four of my radio operators, etc. And so as I see the aircraft falling, as soon as it hits, and I can still see it rocking,
mm-hmm.
I was bolting down this hillside, this mountainside, if you will, probably 50 meters, give or take, bolting down it like a hurdler, I guess you could say, to get down there to render assistance. And as I got, you know, to the bottom where the aircraft was resting, being the commander that I was or were supposed to be, I turned around immediately to start giving instructions to my soldiers, who no doubt had followed me down there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they weren't there. They were probably the smart guys, because it worked out just fine. But at the moment, I mean, we've got an aircraft that's just fell out of the sky. How injured, we don't know at this point, or the pilots, et cetera, crew members. And so, as I say, it wasn't humorous at the time, but I literally turned around to immediately start giving directions and orders, and there was nobody there. And I looked way back up, you know, on the side of this mountain where I just left, and I saw all of my guys saying, "Captain, I think we're smarter than you are, because that thing's fixing to blow up,
mm-hmm.
and we're staying up here, dummy." And, of course, it didn't blow up, and in short order, I did suggest that they join me, which they did. You know, as soon as I told them to get on down here, they did.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't humorous at the time, but when I reflect back, the little vignette I just stated, it was, I'm sure, going through their minds was kind of what I just said. You know, they didn't choose to go down and get blown up, but nothing like that happened. So got them down. We were able to get the soldiers and pilots and all out of the aircraft. We ultimately, of course, they brought a team in to bring these guys out. Plus, we stripped the aircraft of radios and the guns, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of days later, after they'd done whatever they did, I just about blew myself up. It had a pretty good load of avgas on it, and we rigged it to blow it up, because there was no way it could be pulled out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose myself to push the plunger, and I don't know how much cord I had, but I was I thought I was far enough away from the aircraft, but I did get behind a big log or a fallen tree there, and had everybody cleared. I mean, I was the only one down on the ground. Everybody was up on top side now, and I pushed the plunger, doctor on this to blow up this aircraft, and I had a ball of fire that blew over me. Fortunately, as I said, I had taken refuge behind this fallen tree, but I had a ball of fire blow over me and singe my eyebrows and that sort of little thing. Not, I wasn't hurt, you know, really hurt. And again, that's an aside to the finish of that little episode. Well, unbeknownst to me is one of my lieutenants and some of the others wrote up an award for the Soldier's Medal because of my, you know, the Soldier's Medal is not for hostile environment, right? Or at least for hostile action, and certainly this was not hostile territory, but it was just a pure unadulterated accident, if you will. But my actions, impressed my people, and so unbeknownst to me, they submitted me for a very, very nice award, the Soldier's Medal, and obviously I kind of remember that episode pretty well.
Yes,
based upon all the above.
Yes,
but that's the essence of the Soldier's Medal that I almost got blown up twice, but neither time did.
Okay. How much on your second tour did you work with snipers in your unit? Did you have...
No snipers.
No snipers with
no
you.
No snipers.
How about canine units?
We had one mission. Again, this was up in Bin Din Province area. Well, very, very far north because... Well, I know I was on the outer fringes of the artillery fan, and I'll speak to that. We did have a mission. We had some escaped South Vietnamese POWs. And as they'd gone through the processes back in the rear, again, I wound up in this particular case, my company had the mission to take these South Vietnamese soldiers and a canine unit and go back into, they thought they knew about where they were kept in captivity. And so we did a pretty good size operation of taking these ex-prisoners and a canine unit in with us as we searched for the POW camp, if you will, if you could even call it that. You know, it wasn't like something we see in the movies. So we worked with them to include the dogs. We did find one of the locations that they were kept. Of course, there was nobody there then, but there was a huge rice cache there. It just comes to mind because this has been a long time since I've thought about it, but a huge rice cache there. But nothing of any significance from that, other than we did our normal travels, our normal searches, and we had all the unique little circumstances that comes to pass because we had these guys with us. We also had with us, of course, a translator, and I can remember and I'm traveling in a company size element, and I remember. We were out into some pretty dense stuff. We were finding crops. I mean, we were out in the middle of nowhere, and we were finding crops being grown. And ultimately, later on, we get into some, again, that triple canopy stuff where we literally had trails that at least Lambretta-type vehicles were moving on, if not small trucks. And this was very unique and different for me. And on one occasion, I remember I had set up a pretty good sized perimeter, and of course said, you know, okay, take an M16, go down this trail, kind of a thing, high speed avenue of advance here, and was doing whatever I was doing, communicating with my lieutenants, and we got a call that one of our machine gun emplacements out down one trail. He saw some what we call dinks, or what looked like bad guys. So they hesitated to fire. This is one of those classic little unique things. They hesitated to fire because we had South Vietnamese with us, and they didn't know that perhaps these were the South Vietnamese just walking around, although they shouldn't have been outside the perimeter. But what happened was, there was enough hesitation on their part that they were really two bad guys, literally walking down the trail, They made the made a little curve in the trail, and then looked straight down. You know, I don't know how many meters now, but you know, two bad guys walking with their rifles literally thrown back over their shoulder, made this little curve and straight down there, say 50 to 100 meters. I don't know the distance exactly. Was an M60 there with a crew on it, my guys.
Mm-hmm.
But again, my guys saw them, hesitated, actually called back to make to question. Well, so help me, these guys had the wherewithal to, when they saw the M60, they literally waved at our guys.
Hmm.
And it was just, of course, they weren't going to immediately fire anyway because they were trying to be safe, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If we had not had those South Vietnamese with us, then, of course, they would have fired immediately and no doubt killed the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But these were enemy. The enemy did a delaying tactic, so to speak, by raising their hands and waving. It caused, if our guys were really going to fire, which they weren't under the circumstances, but just enough delay that would cause those guys not to fire, and these two guys cut out fast.
Hmm. Okay.
And escaped. I mean, needless to say, we weren't looking for them, but needle in a haystack kind of a thing there.
Right.
But that was kind of, and that happened when our K-9 units were there.
Mm-hmm.
I lost one of my, I loved all my troops, but I had a sergeant, what we used to call a shake and bake, E6.
Mm-hmm.
Had he looked like a takeoff on Herschel Walker.
Okay.
Sergeant Martin Walker was his name. And he was... one of the stories was when he got into base camp, when he first came to the division, and before he came to the field, you know, we lived and died with our poncho liners, and he had a brand-new issued poncho liner.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've mentioned this possibly informally when we were visiting. But nonetheless, he was in the rear at the division base camp, a battalion area barracks, and went outside to use the latrine and came back, and his new poncho liner was gone. You know, there were just a handful of guys there, you know. And so he made an announcement to those in attendance and basically told them, okay, it's gone. I'm going to step back outside. I'll be back in 3 minutes, and it would be best if my poncho liner was back on my rack here.
Mm-hmm.
And miraculously enough, it was.
Okay.
But I want to talk about him, Sergeant Walker.
Okay.
So while we had this K-9 unit, we were in, as I said, into some pretty spooky stuff. And after this episode, well, I'll come to it, but I was a little, for the first time, really and truly, kind of uneasy in the field that I didn't share with any of my troops because we were so far removed from artillery support. I'm not saying we were out of range. That didn't normally happen, but we were on such a far end of it that I don't think we could have gotten very effective firepower out there if we had had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, another one of these stops where we had a nice big perimeter out, and Sergeant Walker's platoon was going to be, it was lunchtime, but we were on our next move out.
Mm-hmm.
Sergeant Walker's platoon, and he had a platoon leader, Lieutenant LaValle, they were going to be my lead platoon. I had just watched this man just days before. We bathed in a river one day.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched him, and when I say shake and bake, he was like a draftee, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And had excelled, you know, in basic and AIT, et cetera, and was able to become a sergeant. So a young soldier, but yet he had all the attributes of what we look for in leadership, because I can remember just two or three days before this incident that I'm fixing to share, I watched him cover his troops while they bathed. In other words, he did just what a good leader's supposed to do. Take care of, you know, the welfare of the troops comes first. And I watched him do this, and I had a great, great respect for him. And what happened is, it was a resupply deal, is what this was. And I remember we had mail breakdown and stuff in the center of the perimeter is where I was. A lot of activity going on. We had the dogs and different things. And all of a sudden, in the midst of all this, choppers have come and gone, I heard a report of a weapon, a rifle fire.
Mm-hmm.
just one shot. Now, realizing that just the day before, I had a soldier from Alabama, old tall, lanky boy, just the day before, take a burst of six in a little firefight, and he survived. And I'm making a comparison that I'm coming to here. So here's a guy that took literally a burst of six and lived to talk about it. Mm-hmm. A day or two before this particular incident.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm talking about a Herschel Walker-looking football player, because this man was going back to Ohio State to play football.
Mm-hmm.
And so I heard the shot, and then almost immediately there was a radio call to my CP radio, and in short order, what I learned was Sergeant Walker had been shot. So I went moving over there as quickly as I could. And I walk down this trail, naughty, naughty, naughty. You know, I preach, 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 preach. You don't walk on trails as such.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened is Sergeant Walker, taking the initiative, he was doing his map reconnaissance and getting his azimuth readings and all. And he walked down this trail, and the last person he spoke to, ironically, when you mentioned K-9, was my K-9 unit guy there.
Mm-hmm.
Was sitting right there on the trail, right where I walked by to go down there.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out he was the last guy to speak to Walker. And all he was doing was stepping outside the perimeter, if you will, just going down this little trail a little ways to check it out, make sure of his readings and all those things. And well, there were bad guys. The enemy was down the trail, and we talk so often about them being the unseen enemy,
mm-hmm.
which they were more times than not. And so Sergeant Walker took one round, and this big, massive, strong body of his, right in the heart.
Mm.
So when I got there, the Lieutenant Bruce LaValle was kind of losing it, because this was one of his key guys, and this was such an odd, shouldn't have happened kind of a thing. And,
mm-hmm.
and he was talking to Sergeant Walker. Well, I knew when I saw the man's eyes that he was dead. And so we had to deal with that. Such a tragedy. And really and truly, I don't throw it back on him, but it was a mistake. It was a mistake on his part, and I don't make light of that by any means.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what we preach and preach, and you can have a false sense of security, which I've taught and taught and taught. We're never safe. And there was just a prime example.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in such terribly high a canopy that when we wrapped him up in a poncho and had to hoist him out by rope, and I just was so bothered. I can still see it. I hadn't thought about it in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the tree, the thickness of all the vegetation, the limbs and all, were just so thick. He just got beat, just got beat up. There's nothing we could do, you know. We had to get him out, and there was no way, it was unheard of by ground. That couldn't even be considered. But I can still see him being pulled up through the trees in a helicopter. Now, we had him covered well, but that bothered me. Well, it still bothers me to this day. They all do, but this one in particular has bothered me over the years, Sergeant Walker.
How do you move forward with your men after such a loss?
Well, again, in our circumstance, now we ultimately, I don't know how or why we got back to base camp, but we ultimately did have a memorial service that I spoke at back in the rear, which was unusual. I guess when we finished this big operation, we were pulled back in.
Mm-hmm.
But in the field, the best I could do was called together. I got to use the chain of command. I have no way to visit on a personal plane with all these 100-plus soldiers. So all I could do was, one, speak to my chain of command, my lieutenants, and possibly their platoon sergeants, but the normal chain would be I would speak, of course, to the lieutenants. They would share back to the platoon sergeants, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But one, speak to the vein of, first of all, It's a tragedy beyond expression, but at the same time, I don't want to lose focus of the fact that there's a lesson to be learned here. And I'm sure that's what I dwelt on more than it's terrible we lost him, but he made a mistake. He made an error, and that's what we're supposed to be all about, not making errors. And let's go back and reinforce what I preach all the time, this security. Was pretty much that. And speaking of that, I can't remember if it was my first or second tour, which sparks this thought when I speak of the unspoken or the unseen enemy. Again, I think I spoke of this informally, but on my second tour, I'm sure it was, is where I had the one, as we were moving out from a night logger, my soldier took a picture of his buddy, turned around and took a picture in this dense foliage, and his buddy was the last guy moving out of that particular site. And then months later, when they get the pictures back, they're looking at the pictures and the picture of his buddy that he took. And the background in the dense jungle, if you will, the dense vegetation, there's a face of of the enemy.
Right.
Guy was already looking at us. I mean, we had our normal LPs and OPs out at night, and we did all of our little stuff, but those little suckers were oftentimes around, and we never knew it.
Did you think that the overall United States policy in Vietnam, and you being on the ground and being one of the implementers of that policy, right there at the spear point, if you will, did you think it was an effective thing, or were there different things that the United States could have done looking back?
Well, there again, at the time, I don't know. Certainly my first tour in particular, I was young and green, and I'm there as a charge of my government to do what my government charges me to do, undeniably, unquestionably, and all that. My second tour, a little wiser perhaps, but still a charge of the government and still under my orders to follow my orders, within reason, of course. And of course, I did that. But on my second tour, I in my own mind, I certainly started questioning how we were going about what we were doing. I suppose by having spent that 5 months or so at brigade level gave me, a much larger picture of the total picture, if you will. And I'm sure I had many discourses, probably from Colonel Warner right on down, as we talked about the concept of what we were doing in Vietnam, etc. But I saw early on in that tenure that what we were doing was mightily ineffective. Okay, in other words, I'm saying, my goodness, we're just walking over this. I'm walking over the same grounds that I walked over 2 years ago, and that the first Cav walked over 2 years before that. We're still going in circles here. What really are we accomplishing? And so, no, I think I don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback, but I think that we certainly did not go about it in the most effective manner. No.
What do you think could have been done differently?
Well, I think that we could have had a. Well, I could go back to a. I've lost the name. I was trying to think of a quote, but I'm not getting it here, Doctor.
Okay. Well,
I think without question, the playing with the borders made all the difference in the world. The old famous Ho Chi Minh Trail that ran, that ran from North Vietnam right on down and infiltrated in, just like my experience at Doc To in 67 when that huge mass infiltration was taking place that ultimately became the Battle of Doc To, where I, with my recon platoon, I've already mentioned, fired artillery, a good part of one night because they were coming in from right there at that corner of Laos and Cambodia, right into Vietnam. And I mean, I was sent out there for a reason, because higher headquarters had to have intel. But I was just one little recon platoon that happened to see them moving at night across the valley, fired artillery on them, and just, within the next 2 or 3 weeks, whatever the time frame, there was one huge major battle where we lost an immense number of soldiers at the Battle of Doc To over Thanksgiving of 67. And especially, I think it was Hill 885, right where I CA'd into as I started my reconnaissance a couple of weeks before. So something like that doesn't add up. I found out the book called SOG by John Plaster. I literally found intelligence in that book. It's by far, in my mind, the best book I have ever read regarding Vietnam, even though it was oriented to quite a degree to SOG operations.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. It's a terrible book when it describes what happened to a lot of our soldiers that were captured, but it gives a great overview of the war at large. And in it, I actually found intel that surrounded my particular. It wasn't addressing me specifically, by no means. But I, after all these years, learned of intelligence that caused me to do what I was doing. Intelligence that I didn't even have then, which was I felt kind of unique and different.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, that aside, the fact that we played the political game. And I don't think the right word is honored the conditions of borders, et cetera. I think that, in my mind, was our greater downfall because that's where the greater part of their logistics was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And we played this little game of dropping little bombs here and there through the trees down to this thing called Ho Chi Minh Trail when we should have just, an understatement or overstatement, how you look at it, we should have, so to speak, gone online. And that's what I was thinking of Goldwater. I mean, I don't make any apologies. Goldwater at one point said, hey, words to the effect, or maybe I've lost it in time, but let's put, B-52s wingtip to wingtip and go north.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get it over. We're going to do it. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to get in the ring with Mike Tyson, you better get in there to fight to win.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's go for it. And I don't think we ever made a full effort to really win the war.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't understand politics, but I understand politics are part of the play here, but we did our soldiers a great injustice by pussyfooting around with this border thing when we knew that they were there.
What did you think of the body count policy?
Over the years, as I have read, I never had a problem, or it never was a factor of any sort in my own personal experience. In other words, it was never suggested to me that, of course, they always wanted to know what your body count was, understand that, but there was never ever an event that, or a higher commander that told me that I should, as I've read so often, that we need, well, if you've got four, then there must really be another eight, whatever that equation might be. I never had any personal dealings with anything outside the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt pressured by anybody to do that.
Okay.
Now, human beings are human beings, and there are guys with egos and this, that, and the other, and the reality of life is I'm sure there were false reports just from an egotistical standpoint. I'm just speaking totally for the first time off the top of my head that
mm-hmm.
A given person, a lieutenant that took the oath just as I did, in his own value system, might say, "Well, his two kills represent 12 to him," and report it unequivocally as 12 in his own mind, heart, and soul. I could never ever begin to even think about doing something like that, but there's no doubt that it did, and there's no doubt, as I've read over the years, there was pressure brought on from higher headquarters at various places for that count to be higher. I guess I'm just an honest guy, but I can't deal with that. I wouldn't.
Okay. Continue with your second tour. As you were getting shorter and shorter, did you do anything differently? Did you take different measures in the field for yourself personally?
Not really. That makes me think back to what I was speaking of earlier, though, that will be part of the answer to that, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time, after we got Sergeant Walker out of there and finished up that particular operation, as I said, we were out at the father stands, the artillery fan, and we were in such thick stuff, there were no LZs anywhere, and it came time for us to be pulled out,
Mm-hmm.
And we really wound up, it seems like a couple of days at least, I had one lieutenant that was really good with the demolitions.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, we used, and we all did it to a degree, but I mean, we had to blow an LZ, and I don't mean just dropping a 500-pound bomb and blowing it out. I mean, we had to go chopping literally tree by tree and blowing the bigger ones. And this is a time, this is probably, I was derosing in July. This could have been either late May or June, but I mean, I was starting to get pretty short.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never suffer principle from me or anybody else, but certainly I had in my mind that I am getting short, and I'll tell about my last CA. But but this was the time, the first time, and I can say it without question, I was really, really concerned, and it was an intuitive thing, because there was no intelligence ever presented to me to support what I'm going to say. But I know in my own mind, and I'm not trying to dramatize it, as I say, we were so far out there, and there was areas where there'd been at least many trucks, whatever they might be out there. I mean, big trails under the canopy, which means there can be some hellacious reinforcements brought in, or you know, what have you. And so we were delayed getting out of there a few days because we just couldn't come up with an LZ.
Mm-hmm.
So final decision, we just got to blow one and cut one, and we just cut and cut and blew and blew, but this took so much time. And each night, whether it was two or three nights, in my own mind, I tell you, and I shared this with no one, I was, first of all, fearful for my troops, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because I just felt we were so far away from everything, and by being so far away, we were in his haven.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never know, but I just believe in my mind that the bad guys were massing a force to annihilate us. Now, that's just Jim Wheeler. I mean, that's where I was emotionally, worrying about my soldiers. I wasn't trying to make too much of it. But at the same time, if I could ever really know, I would just believe that where we were, and it was in his ambiance, if you will, that
mm-hmm.
I just believe if we had been there another day or two, I just believe we would have been into one hell of a fight with a force much, much, much superior to ours.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know that. Thank God we didn't have to experience it, because we finally got out of there. And I've got pictures of the dogs on the LZ at that time, etc. But we got out, and that was the only time that I was ever really and truly consciously fearful in a sense. A word about my soldiers. I mean, just the normal course of the day, of course you are, but this is ratcheted up, you know, another three or four notches, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Somewhere in there, I got, now, I'm not without error. One day, we're up in these darn mountains, and we got mortared a couple of times. But I had my platoons working separately, and I had, it's terrible that I don't remember his name, but I had on his 21st birthday, I had a young man who was Hollywood handsome,
mm-hmm.
great, great heart, great kid. I could still see him cutting, chopping up on point. Good kid, and they got into, his platoon, he became a victim of a booby trap, which was very, very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a serious booby trap. It killed one kid, and this kid lost his legs below. I believe that he lived, but it was on his 21st birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they weren't a great distance from where my CP group was, and so I made an error. Here I am talking about all this stuff, but I'm not without fault. I was up on the top of one mountaintop, so to speak, hilltop, but it was in the mountains, and they were down the hill and up the other side or what have you into another little valley. And so I grabbed my radio operator,
mm-hmm.
and my medic. There were two of us, possibly three, but I know for sure I took my medic, of course, because we had wounded, and at least one radio. May have just been the three of us, possibly a fourth person. But we were up where there were lots of trails. Now, we've been traversing this area for some days now. And so I grabbed these guys as a captain, the company commander, and took off. Now, I guess my, you know, I had a platoon out there and my security, and maybe they were going to follow me later, but we're just three or four on our own. And I take off boogieing down this trail, leading the way because I'm trying to get to these wounded. And straight down this trail was, I can still see it. It just looked like almost like a cartoon with the Roadrunner when they paints a trestle thing on the side of a mountain. I can, in other words, we were kind of, it was kind of broken up vegetation, but straight down this trail, it looked just like a black pit. It looked like a black door, so to speak, into this real thick vegetation that we were fixing to have to go through, you know, go through there down this trail. Well, dadgum, if somebody didn't start shooting at us. But what they did, and it wasn't an AK. This is, again, you don't want to kill a friendly, right? You don't want to shoot a friendly. And so I'm walking, and here comes a this guy, this person is shooting at us. But he walked it down the trail. In other words, rather than shooting it at, let's just say, at knee or waist level, straight down the trail, he could have shot us all.
Okay.
But I was just like a movie and like in slow motion, because just like when you see the bullets hit the ground, it was just popping up dirt straight down the trail at us. And so just like we were trained to do, we you know, dived off to the side of the trail, right? Well, I didn't immediately return fire because they weren't AKs. And more than once, especially working at Brigade, I knew that we had LERPs out and about that we didn't necessarily even know were there. Sometimes the LERPs, the long-range reconnaissance patrols, would get lost. And so because the weapon wasn't that was fired was not an AK, and I can't say if it's I can't say if it was an M16, but anyway, it wasn't an AK, and my concern was I didn't want to return fire, as silly as that sounds, and kill a friendly, all right, even though he's shooting at us. I didn't know if it was a spooked alert. I don't know, and we never knew. We never really knew. So, if, as it turns out, we ultimately broke contact. And but to this day, I don't know. I would have to presume it was the bad guys, because I never really knew, and we never, you know, saw these guys. But that became, I mean, that was a little squirrely for a little while because we didn't know what was coming next necessarily. But once we got through all that and got down, and the more important part was to get to these wounded soldiers, was that.
Okay.
And that was probably a month or so before my return to the States. And yes, there's no question in my mind that I was concerned that I wanted to go home to my wife and daughter. But I am a principled person, and there was no way I would ever suffer principle or shortchange anything in the scenario of operating in the field. Yeah, internally, yeah, I certainly want to go home, but I'm still going to do my job, and I'm not trying to be rah-rah about that. That's just Jim Wheeler.
Right.
But ironically, on my last combat assault, which is like, let's see if I can get it on this third oak leaf cluster to the Purple Heart. Let's see if we got the date here. 28th, oh, that can't be right. Oh, 28th day of June. So this, I think my DeRose date was the 11th of July. So on the 28th of June, a day before my wife's birthday, we're making a big, huge move. We got CH-47s. Well, what it was, my company was going into an old fire base, a small fire base, a little like a battery-sized artillery. To secure this, I think there were 105s, a little artillery base, and it was terrible because we were going into an area that was the old bunkers and all is still there and all the sandbags, but it's grown over with elephant grass. Terrible stuff, elephant grass. And so we got in there and big air assault into there, and what happened is the bad guys had put punji stakes just everywhere, and of course the jungle just takes over anyway, and it just high elephant grass everywhere, And all of a sudden, I don't remember the number, I had any number of guys walking in, you know, getting stuck in different manners mm-hmm. with punji sticks. Well, meanwhile, we've got all this aircraft coming. We got CH-47s bringing in the tubes and the artillery rounds, et cetera. So I'm on the ground out there running here and there trying to direct my troops to where I want them, you know. You know, first platoon, you know, you'll take from 12 to 4, you know, that sort of a thing. That's your sector, the perimeter. Get your machine guns here. All this kind of, just the standard stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm walking down this little trail, meandering through what was once a little fire base, and there was a punji stake. Of course, I didn't see it was under the grass, but a punji stake was sticking out to my left front, and boy, it caught my left calf mm-hmm. and ripped me very good, and real good, and so that kind of did me in. I mean, I ultimately had to. I actually was medevaced. You can't even call it medevaced. I was ultimately crawled onto a CH-47 mm-hmm. to get back to the forward supply base area, mm-hmm. and they basically dumped me out. And I crawled off of the sea. Here I am, a captain, the commander of this company. And see, I'd been wounded with a modest punji stake about a month or two before, mm-hmm. and chose not to go to the rear. And my battalion commander learned about it, and he chewed me a good one, mm-hmm. and told me one of his visits. You know, the word. I mean, my medic, you know, worked on it in the field and all. And fortunately, it did not get infected or cause me any serious problems. But as you know, the punji stakes, generally speaking, were dipped in feces and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. But he was, I guess, internally he was impressed that I stayed with my troops that time. But at the same time, as a commander, he had the responsibility to tell me, hey, boy, you know, Captain, mm-hmm. you know, you need to look after yourself. So this time, this was much, much worse. And so I wound up crawling off this CH-47, this Chinook, out in the middle of this great big old resupply field, and way across the way there, probably 100, 200 meters, I could see the tents of the resupply, you know, different companies. Mm-hmm. But I was helpless. I couldn't walk. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Somehow somebody must have seen me. I mean, it had to, but I mean, I finally got picked up and was hauled off to the little quasi hospital there. And when I got there, I've got all my soldiers. There must have been a half a dozen or so, a doctor, lying on these cots outside, you know, being evaluated before we are taken into the operating room. Mm-hmm. So I got on a cot, and to my immediate left was my FO's radio operator, who I called Audie Murphy, and then three or four more guys before him. And the doctors were coming down the line, and they get to this kid. And as I say, I call him Marty Murphy. He was a radio operator for our forward observer. Mm-hmm. But every time we had a little firefight, he wanted to play infantry, you know. Instead of stay on his radio and work with his lieutenant, he was always wanting to get into the mix of things. And so I nicknamed him Audie Murphy. So he was a tough little guy, right? Mm-hmm. So he has a pretty good hole in his leg, and the doctor walks up. And here I am, he sticks his finger in this guy's wound, right, to feel around for any, you know, foreign matter, what have you. And of course, my young soldier, he levitated off the table about a foot mm-hmm. in pain. And so I'm the next guy. Mm-hmm. And so, and I kid you not, I, in the midst of all the emotions that are going on, the fact that I've had to, you know, I'm 2 weeks. Here's this emotional thing, I guess you could say. I'm 2 weeks from going home. I've had to leave my company because I'm wounded, and the last thing I wanted to do was get stuck with a punji stake. And I guess I just thought I was above it, you know. Mm-hmm. How could I get stuck? Well, easy. It's all camouflage stuff. But anyway, and all these emotions going on and the pain of it. And then I see my toughy little Spec 4 hurting so badly when this guy sticks his finger in his leg. So I was next. And so I remember laying my hand down off of the cot. This sounds crazy, Richard, but it's true. I was going to hit this guy if he thought about sticking his finger into this leg wound of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know they've got to do that, but hey, we can go to the operating room. And so I don't know if I'd have done it, but I really was totally prepared because I remember dropping my hand off the cot to rear back and get his attention. But fortunately, I it was probably because I was the captain when they got to me. And they probably already knew, but they obviously saw that I was the captain here, and they hauled me into to the operating room
mm-hmm.
immediately,
okay.
and opened it up and did all that stuff. But that kind of ended up my tour, except for the story I've already told you regarding, because you know, after I was released from the hospital, I was just back in the division base camp for two or three days to write OERs and things, and was on crutches, et cetera. And I told you the one story of the NCO.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever able to say goodbye to your men?
No.
Has that bothered you, or did it bother you at the time?
You know, it's happening so quickly. At the time, I think you're just caught up in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I remember, I can remember at least one of my lieutenants, and I don't even know how he got out of the field. I remember one of my lieutenants coming to the hospital to visit. How he did that, I don't know offhand, but no, that was kind of the way it worked there, in a sense. I cared for my soldiers, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I know I did a good job in my heart and mind and soul today, so that I know that a lot of them live because of my attention to detail.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, it was just the way it worked. I no way I could formally see them.
Right.
No. And you just go with the flow, I guess.
Right. You didn't have any control over the matter.
Not at all.
Yeah. Let me ask you a couple of general questions. Do you know if you were ever exposed to Agent Orange or any of the other defoliants?
Well, according to the Department of Veterans Affairs, I was, and I say that lightly, of course.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that's what I deal with every day, as you know.
Right.
First of all, any soldier that served in country in Vietnam is presumed to have been exposed. That's just a statement. There are some who know unequivocally that they were, because either it happened or they've played it so much in their minds that they just know they were sprayed. And I'm sure that there are occasions of that. I mean, I've had guys tell me that they got wet from it.
Mm-hmm.
God love them. I mean, because we didn't know the significance of it at that time. I dare say that I was exposed to it. I cannot say that I watched an airplane fly over
mm-hmm.
and watched the mist fall into the foliage. And I also know that the greater part of my time spent was in the Central Highlands,
mm-hmm.
just in the bush at large, where there was no regular defoliating going on.
Mm-hmm.
But around a fire base or something like that where it was used, I mean, I had to be in proximity of it. But to know emphatically, I don't. And yet, just yesterday, I had a DD-214 sent to me from another county, where the guy is not happy with his veteran service person and has heard of me, if you will, and wants me to help him.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me an article out of a newspaper that was just in the paper over the weekend that gives the statistics of. And I wish I had it before me, of how badly the Vietnamese people of today are still suffering the consequences of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave some pretty interesting. I have it saved. It's just in a folder, not at my desk,
mm-hmm.
where these people are. You know, it still can be. You know, they can still identify in various sources. You know, in the ground, dirt, what have you. Surely it's not still in the water, but somehow it's still about and still seeping
mm-hmm.
and causing, you've been there, and causing serious health problems to those people there yet today.
Right. What kind of drug and alcohol use did you witness during your two tours?
this is an area that I have gotten on my soapbox on behalf of the 4th Division soldiers many times mm-hmm. in a very proud way. Again, fortunately, I've mentioned the fact the way we operated in the 4th Division, we weren't faced with a lot of booby trap circumstances, and for that I'm grateful.
Mm-hmm.
And in like manner, our soldiers, for the most part, spent 99% of their time in the field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not a scientific percentage, but what I'm saying is they didn't have access to those things, such as just picking the 1st Infantry Division, who operated in and around Saigon as an example, where they were in the mix of populated areas and had access to those things more readily.
Mm-hmm.
I've been given classes on marijuana as a lieutenant, and it's one of those things that once you smell the pungent smell of marijuana, you know that smell.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say, with my hand on this SOG book, or the Bible, so to speak, is mm-hmm. I never once, and shame on me if I was this oblivious to it, I know I never once smelled marijuana in the field in my two years in Vietnam.
Okay.
I never once smelled any marijuana. Certainly no alcohol. It seems like we used to get a beer in the field, like two sodas and one beer or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, that's hot. Well, it's not even like alcohol anyway. I mean, mm-hmm. golly, it's like insignificant, but it was a non-issue. But in all of my time in Vietnam, I did not personally have one circumstance, one issue whatsoever of drug and alcohol. And the story that I've given is the life in a nutshell here. The life of a 4th Division soldier, doctor, was he came to the division. He was given a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
If he was lucky, he got to go sight it before he was put on an aircraft and flown to the field.
Mm-hmm.
For the next 6 months. He humped every day. He dug a hole every night. So he slept, maybe 4 hours a night.
Mm-hmm.
And then every third night or so, he's probably out on LPOP. He wake up the next morning and do the same thing for 6 months. And if he lived for 6 months, he got to go on R&R for a week.
Mm-hmm.
He comes back from R&R, and he gets to come back to the field and do the same exact thing every day for the next 6 months. Hump. Dig a hole, hump, dig a hole. There was no access to the civilian. I'm not saying my guys wouldn't do it necessarily, or didn't do it on occasion, whatever it would have been. But I mean, in the field, I never had any issue with it whatsoever, and I say that so proudly about my soldier, the guy that fought the war.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's not to say that that same kid in the heart of Saigon, at 19, with all the booze and broads and drugs, that he may not would have partaken. And that's part of my story, though, is those guys, and I'm not calling them bad, they're the guys that had access to it. They're the guys that the writers wrote about, because I never had any writer make the trip all the way up to Pleiku and all the way out into Bien Dinh province to hump with my unit, where the real war was at. They stayed in general terms, in my mind, in and around Saigon, and that's the kind of story they wrote. Well, remember, there's 8 support troops to 1 grunt. The grunt fought the war, and there were 8 guys back there in the rear supporting him, and yes, they had access to, they partook, as young men will, but I think the guy that fought the war, really fought the war, got a bad rap for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's my story of the 4th Division soldier.
Okay. Jim, what would you say was the bravest action you witnessed during your 2 tours?
The bravest action I ever saw personally?
Yes, sir.
I don't know if it was the bravest one, but I mentioned my first tour, my first 7 or 9 days, and I wish I knew which, but I remember we had some kind of a contact with the enemy mm-hmm. every day, and it seemed like it was always saddle up second, which was my platoon, mm-hmm. which was okay. But on, I think is when I mentioned to you, I did not know what the sound of a bullet sounded like passing your head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking to movies now, pop that cap and stuff, and that's what it kind of sounds like. Well, I remember this is one of those very first days when I probably should have died because the guys were in the tree shooting back at us, and I've described this already, but it's not about, but that particular event, we were in a huge, burned out, bombed out big field that we were having to advance forward, and there were snipers, or at least riflemen up in the trees shooting back at us. Now, they were fighting down below there at a water point with our water resupply guys. This is why we were having to go down to break their contact. But they'd set up something of an ambush, knowing full well that we would come down.
Mm-hmm.
They were fixed to shoot back at us.
Mm-hmm.
So this was in those first two or three days, and I remember being behind that, jumping down behind this burned out tree thing stump, and doing my my arm and hand signals.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, just a day or two before is when I had the E6, when I had that first contact where my RTO was shot sitting next to me through the mm-hmm. neck, and I was doing that, doing my thing,
mm-hmm.
and literally wound up crawling over an E6 mm-hmm. that I call a lifer,
right.
hiding in the midst of this battle.
Right.
And so here I was seeing an E6 hiding, and now this day, I'm getting to the point, is this, he was a black kid, I forget where he was from, but he was a U.S., a draftee, and he took command of my left flank. I can see him as I'm lifting my hand right now,
mm-hmm.
Watching Specialist Johnson move those forces, because they were out of the clearing into the woods area, and I had lost visual control of them. And could not work with them effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And my point is, he, in the midst of all the firing that was coming at us, he stood up and he moved these troops like a seasoned pro.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it was is very valorous on his part. Was it the most the greatest thing I saw over there? Well, it was pretty close,
mm-hmm.
just because of the uniqueness to me that early in my tenure. And what I had already just seen a day or two before.
Right.
But I saw that a lot, Richard. That's the point. I saw that in our young soldiers. You know, it's my understanding, what I've read, the average age of a World War II soldier was 25.
Mm-hmm.
The average age of a Vietnam soldier was 19.
Mm-hmm.
And I love them so dearly because that's an example. This kid was a draftee, just like Sergeant Walker was.
Mm-hmm.
But they went there, and they served in a marvelous capacity. You know, statistically, only about 20% of the weapons, riflemen fired their weapons in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it was about 80 or maybe 90% in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of reasons for that. I understand training and all, but I'm saying the Vietnam soldier, the kid that fought the war, was magnificent. They stood up and were counted. They did their job day in and day out. And am I overstating it or trying to overly romanticize it? I'm not, because I just had little to no problems.
Well, that's what you witnessed.
That's what I witnessed. That's
right.
All I know.
Right. Is there a particularly humorous event that stands out in your mind when you think back?
Well, the most humorous, I've told you, it was my big element to the front.
Mm-hmm.
You remember?
Yes.
The kid that I sent out on that patrol,
mm-hmm.
and the big element, which turned out to be a big elephant.
Right.
That was without question the most humorous thing that I experienced.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can chuckle about the one I gave you. It's not nearly the same, but with those two bad guys waving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is smart soldiering. Those guys were trained.
Mm-hmm.
Just long enough to make the difference in getting away.
Right.
And, you know, those kind of little things. This isn't so funny. We were, in my first tour, when we had gotten our APCs, we were breaking trail one day, and here we are, literally out in a free fire zone. Bad guys can be anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting in the cupola of my APC, and I've got two tracks in front of me,
mm-hmm.
and one of them here we are in our flak jackets, our steel pots, etc. And this this APC pushes up to this tree, mm-hmm. which may have been, you know, 3 inches in diameter or something like that, but just pushes up to it to push it over. Mm-hmm. Well, when he hit it, a big nest of hornets fell down.
Oh, boy.
Chakoom! Right down on top of the APC, and you had, you know, you had the track driver down below in front. You had the other guy, you know, the track commander and the cupola and the guy sitting around the top. Mm-hmm. And I stood there. Now, again, it wasn't humorous at the time. But it was to see these guys. It did not matter if they had been in a firefight. You've never seen helmets thrown, flak jackets ripped off, thrown. I mean, these guys. In the midst of, and we weren't in a firefight, so it wasn't like we were, but the bad guys could have just been right there too.
Right.
But the bad guy in this case, I don't know if they were hornets or bees, but this nest fell down and these guys disrobed in a hurry. Threw stuff everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And they were, you know, stung pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that these were another time, on the ground. I remember getting some guys getting into that kind of a deal,
mm-hmm.
and we actually had to medevac them. They were stung so badly
wow.
that they had to be pulled out.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's probably 1,000 other little stories that I just can't pull up to mind, but
mm-hmm.
But yeah, you had to have the good humor.
Mm-hmm.
Had to have a little humor there to see it through, I think.
Okay. Jim, let's take a break.
All right.
Okay, Jim, let's pick up with you leaving Vietnam. After you recovered from your wounds, how long did it take you to recover from that wound?
Well, I left country on crutches. I remember getting to Cameron Bay, which was our exit point, and having the leg serviced there because I had, like, it was like metal. It was sewn up with metal thread, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of an odd stuff, but... Mm-hmm. But literally left on crutches because, ironically enough, when we left Vietnam, and of course it was in a commercial airliner,
mm-hmm.
we had a stop in Japan.
Right.
And of all things, when we're so anxious to get home, right,
mm-hmm.
the plane broke down.
Oh, no.
And so we had an overnight in Japan. I mean, we were on a base, and you know, I guess just got BOQ quarters. But I remember hobbling on my crutches with, you know, a group of guys, officers, as we went over to the officers' club, I guess, to eat dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But the irony was, the last thing we wanted on Earth was to be delayed, and something on the airplane broke and caused us to
right.
stay over maybe an extra night, not an inordinate amount of time, but an hour was inordinate in our minds, but
mm-hmm.
certainly. You know, a 12-hour to 24-hour period, we were delayed getting out of there.
What was that flight out of Vietnam like when you cleared Vietnamese airspace?
You know, no question, we were happy boys. But you know, I've said this to someone recently. I don't remember an awful lot about any of those flights.
Hmm.
I mean, I just, you know, I know. I can remember leaving there. I certainly remember arriving. I think it was in Seattle is where we landed, and then I had to get my commercial or civilian flights on to El Paso. But
mm-hmm.
I just really don't remember a lot about the flight. I just don't. For whatever the reason, maybe I was already stateside in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember that. I just do know that the steward I, if you will, were very pleasant and warm to us. They were very gracious to us. I can, you know, remember that.
Right.
But I don't remember who I sat by. I don't remember any conversations or anything whatsoever like that. I think I was in my own little world,
mm-hmm.
just wanting to extract myself from there and be with my family.
What was your reception in Seattle with civilian airlines and being in the civilian airport? Any incidents?
No. And I'm going to make a little comparison, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
You're an amazing guy, Richard. You know, you get me talking. I don't know the way you do it, but you just cause me to think of things, and I appreciate that because we don't dwell in this world, understandably. But another area that I have talked about before, and I don't make light of anybody that had the negativity surround them in an airport, and there's no doubt that it happened. But I once heard Bart Starr, Green Bay's quarterback, say, after all the years that he had been, so to speak, on the speaking circuit and speaking at all the events that he's been to over the years, he said words to the effect, if everybody that has told me that they were at the Ice Bowl was really in that stadium that day, you know, the stadium would have had to been 4 to 5 times the size as it is. Okay? And my little analogy, not making light of any ill-received soldier, but I walked through, you know, I went and came back twice. And so there's four opportunities. I flew out of L.A., I think, the first or second time, or maybe both times, and I came back. I never had one incident whatsoever, and I assure you, had I had, I would have known it, because I would have been very, would have pulled no punches. But my comparison to Bart Starr is simply, and I've qualified it already, if as many guys were spit on as is told the tale, the clothing would still be in the cleaners. And I mean, I think that it happened, but I think it's a line that's gotten a bit overused. In my own mind, I don't know that actually, you know, factually, but in my own mind, I don't think it happened to the great numbers that it's been reported.
Okay.
That's just Jim Wheeler on it.
Okay.
But I never had a problem.
Okay.
And I assure you, I'd have grabbed them by the throat if anybody even looked like they wanted to spit on me. We would have had a little firefight right there, so to speak.
You were in uniform, weren't you?
Yeah. I would have grabbed them. Oh, yeah. It would have not been pretty. And when I have guys in here, and I deal with guys here that start saying that, and I have to evaluate those things, you know, and when I hear them say that, as just using an example here, Richard, and they show it with no emotion, they say it with no emotion, they don't bang on my desk, they don't grit their teeth. That, in my own mind, Jim Wheeler, that tells me this never happened. This didn't happen to you. I get emotional about it just talking about it if it happened to me. And you're sitting there telling me you were spit on and you just walked on through a hockey puck. I just think that kind of unscientifically supports my little theory, but that's my story.
Okay. Did you have 30 days leave?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What was it like coming back home to El Paso?
Heaven on earth,
yeah.
Needless to say. Needless to say. Both times, of course. And of course, we basically, we had 30 days, and I'm a homeboy, so I, of course, my wife being in proximity of her parents the year I was gone, we were, you know, quickly in the car and heading to Memphis, Tennessee to see my folks. And especially this particular, no, maybe in the first trip, though. I ate hamburgers. I think it was the first trip more than so this. I'm a hamburger guy, as you know. We talked about it, eating. I ate hamburgers morning, noon, and night. Morning, noon, and night. My mother was prone to cook me hamburgers growing up anyway for breakfast, silly as it sounds.
Okay.
And I just remember eating hamburgers. Every place we stopped, I ate hamburgers. It was one of the things I remember about vacation.
How much did you talk about your war experience with first with your family members and then with other military people in the military and then civilians?
Well, I think the family, not too much problems necessarily. I guess with my brother who had served in Vietnam for a year with the Air Force, but I think the family at large really didn't know how to go about approaching it. In fact, I had a little friction with my sister at one point, I remember, because she seemed, and I don't know if it was a defense, but she was so unspoken to it, I mean, that it was almost, to me, it was almost insulting that, you know, what I just did. And I have to accept it as honesty. She said, I just felt awkward, or I didn't think you wanted to talk, you know, that, those kind of standard statements there. So from a family perspective, there wasn't a whole lot of discourse outside maybe of my brother, certainly my mother. There was nothing to talk about with her in that regard, as an example. My dad was World War II, but it wasn't a whole lot to talk about, I don't believe.
Did they ask about it?
Modestly. Again, I think it's a matter of trying, I guess presupposing themselves into your mind, but they're trying to be nice about it, because war is an ugly thing. Mm-hmm. And war does have its atrocities, and so I think they were just trying to be considerate, I guess you could say, of my own emotions, if you will.
Okay.
So no, there was no real sit down and long discourses, no, about the war with at large, no.
How about civilians? And I want to lead into your thoughts about the anti-war movement.
Sure. There again, my life, though, even though I realize at this moment, as we're speaking, I'm on a 30-day leave, but and it wasn't anything that I would hide other than the fact, obviously, I have the stickers on my car for getting on post, but I didn't hide the fact by any means that I was a soldier, and I'm sure my haircut showed it, but there wasn't any, I don't remember anything out of the ordinary as we traveled around with on our little vacation. And then, unlike, as I said to you before, and unlike the standard young man who went to war as either a U.S. or an RA for 3 years and went back home to the block, as they say, mm-hmm. my environment was pure military. Mm-hmm. So I think that certainly caused it to be a totally different event, in a sense, than the guy that goes back home and is right back out in the factory floor or mm-hmm. whatever he's doing, where there was a bit more anti-war kind of a circumstance. My whole environment is military, so that's all I really basically knew.
Okay. All right. What did you think of the anti-war movement? How did it affect you when you came back, and what were your thoughts?
Well, certainly being the kind of citizen that I am, and not to mention military person, I was not very happy with all that was going on with that. And again, I have to be careful thinking about then versus the knowledge, if you will, that I have today. Obviously, a lot of time has passed and a lot of reading and all the above. But at the time, again, I'm probably operating in my, Jim Wheeler speaking again, of course, just somewhat with blinders on, because I am something of an idealistic person to this day. Mm-hmm. My government has gone to war for what they believe to be the right thing, and I'm in charge of them, and so that's what I do. It isn't really up to me if, to be, frankly, questioning or challenging too much in my everyday role as a military officer, just trying to do the best I can with the job assignment that I have, period. So I think, you know, we're kind of non-political military guys by makeup and by design, I guess you could say, as well. And mm-hmm. and so, I've called myself over the years quite a bit, I'm a non-political animal, certainly during those years, for the most part. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't a part of my makeup.
Okay.
It would.
What about the anti-war movement now? Looking back.
Looking back to Vietnam, you're talking about?
Yes, sir.
Well, certainly, I think the citizenry at large were sold, probably not the right term, certainly to a certain degree, a bill of goods. Mm-hmm. Because there again, I've said it so many times over the years. You know, what's the problem here? We were just soldiers, just like Koreans. We're just the boy next door, mm-hmm. doing what the government has asked of us. Mm-hmm. But of course, it was, as you know much better than I, as a historian, it was media driven. Mm-hmm. There was I guess lies. I mean, the government, our citizens were lied to a certain degree, both from over there with Westmoreland. Not to mention over here with LBJ and the Whiz Kids. Mm-hmm. I gave more credit at the time. I thought McNamara, well, he was certainly quite an intelligent man, but in retrospect, and I tried to read his book. My wife got me his book of apology of sorts, but I just couldn't get into his book. And I guess because I saw how really the how we were really used. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, again, by being a little older and wiser, I see, well, yeah, a guy from his background, yes, he was a very intelligent man, but what did he know about what he was doing anyway in that role, as you reflect back? But at the time, I just saw, you know, a bright man, if you will, intelligent man, but obviously with a lot of mistakes on all fronts, really.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the media coverage of the war? You just alluded to that.
Well, I think anything that could be painted negative was done that way. I think in my mind the media was the greatest negative impact of the whole war. I think the way it was, the way the media was used in the liberal attitude of it all, mm-hmm. is what, if you will, turned the population in a sense. And I'm not speaking nearly as smart and sharp as I should to you on that subject, but I think the media was the core of the problem.
Okay.
I mean, I realized that all the politics that went into building the puppet government and all those kind of things, they're there too, and, mm-hmm. and they weren't right, but I just think our own media really, really twisted it for us.
Okay. How much did you keep up with what was happening in Vietnam after you came back to the United States?
Well, I was... Again, just by being wearing the uniform and having it was still our war, I was fairly tuned to it.
Mm-hmm.
I must say much more so than I am with the, I mean, I monitor Iraq, but I'm certainly not as emotionally involved. I'm very much concerned and interested in all the above, but certainly that being my war, I was tuned to it quite a bit more because, again, it was impacting on me in some way most every day. As just serving on the active duty at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I was simply around fellow soldiers that had the same experience, and it was kind of more of a common circumstance versus being out in the civilian environment.
What did you think of the Vietnamization policy of turning the war over to the South Vietnamese to fight for themselves?
Well, first of all, obviously we knew it was doomed to failure to begin with. It turned out to be that way. In fact, it happened so quickly, it's almost embarrassingly so. But then, quite frankly, that's the way I saw the South Vietnamese soldiers operate, you know, in my little time there. As I said early on, I saw them. I'd heard stories of them running in battle, and in one of my first firefights, what did I experience? Running in battle. And it was such a confusing thing to a second lieutenant. What am I doing here fighting for him if he's running? And I don't think it got a whole lot better. It never got any better.
Okay. Do you remember how you felt in 1973 when the United States officially withdrew from Vietnam?
Well, I felt... I never have, and I'm not trying to beat a dead horse. I don't, because we never lost a major battle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I personally, if you whip me, I accept that. But I don't feel that we, the soldiers, lost the war.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in the same breath, you can say we did lose over there, but we lost at the political levels. But at the fighting man level, we did what we were charged to do, even though we could have done it a lot better in a lot of different ways. But I don't accept that we lost the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you can say, well, yeah, we did. But I don't accept that from a soldier's perspective.
Okay.
Because I think it dishonors the soldiers that fought and died over there to say that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question of what was to come with the Vietnamization of it all. No, I mean, there's just no stopping that. And I mean, our government had to know that, understandably, when that was finally done, that in short order, it would happen. And my God, it happened probably quicker than I thought it would happen,
mm-hmm.
the way the communists rolled down from the north.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel in 1975 when that happened?
I, again, not surprised, but not happy about it. Well, first of all, I didn't want to see a... You can call it a democratic country, but see a country, South Vietnam in this case, literally taken over by a communist regime. From the perspective of freedom versus communism, if you will, mm-hmm. I was not at all pleased whether I'd been there or not. You hate to see that take place.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think the United States achieved peace with honor, as was said during the time?
No, I don't. Peace with honor?
Yes, sir. Kissinger and Nixon.
No. It's a blight on our history. Nothing about it was good. Nothing about tidying it up or wrapping it up or nothing about it was done in my mind as it should have been done. That's a very broad statement, I know, but no, I'm not at all pleased. And then when you compound Nixon on top of it, just makes it worse.
Let's expand on that. What kind of lessons did the United States learn from this experience?
Well, I guess from a soldier's perspective, which is if you're going to commit to a war, you need to commit to it fully and wholly, with no holds barred, so to speak. Sure, today we can look back and say, but it's like if you go back and look at McCarthyism, you can look back at that and it almost seems like a joke. How could that have happened? But living in those times, it was a very real thing. And then what I'm working back to is, of course, the domino effect of what we were seeing and believing and expecting to take place. And I know it goes well past that, but in the simplest terms, the United States government just did not want another country, regardless of its size or location, shaded in with the communist red,
mm-hmm.
And that's what we saw and believed and kind of only knew. That was our box. Again, today, looking back, it's you could say, what a joke this is, when you start looking at the domino theory. I mean, how silly can this be, going back to Truman? But that's what, those are the conditions we were living under, and I'd like to think that for the most part our government was seeking for that not to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But there we were, mixing into somebody else's government and trying to install our own, et cetera, et cetera. And I hope we learned that that really doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work, just like you don't go over there with any forethought of trying to put a long haul rice when they eat short haul rice, or whatever the right term is. I mean, you don't change those things.
Mm-hmm.
You can't change them, nor should you. But we tried. We failed.
You think the politicians in Washington, the policymakers, are more to fault than the military commanders in the field?
Emphatically.
Okay.
Yeah, we talk about the puppet government of Vietnam, but we also commanders over there. I know that as I've done some reading, certainly I don't think there was ever a man in a uniform that looked any more military than General Westmoreland. I mean, he just looks the perfect part of a general officer.
Mm-hmm.
But did he not get caught up in politics? Of course he did. And I'm sure Eisenhower did in his own way, in Europe, of course. But
mm-hmm.
I still may be a bit too idealistic in my world, Richard, but because I know the world is a dirty place and it isn't squeaky clean and easy to work within. But and I know that guys go to Washington with the best of intentions and get caught up in all the power lead of it all, and I'm sure to a degree Westmoreland had to play that game too. But there was some lying and deceit going on, and that's what bothers me. As much as anything.
Okay. How do you feel about your personal service in Vietnam?
I'm very pleased with, I'm very comfortable with my time there. And as I said to you before, if I hadn't met my sweetie, I wouldn't have left anytime soon. And that would have been another story for me. I could have very easily died over there, and I don't say that for drama, but I've said that to my wife because that's probably true. But for me, Jim Wheeler, I know that I did my job to the best of my abilities. Mm-hmm. I know that I did not suffer a principal. I know that I was lost on more than one occasion when we don't like to admit it, but that's just a little sidebar because we always say, you know, a guy tells you he was never lost in Vietnam. You have to say he lies because the maps weren't the greatest, and more than once I've stood somewhere and fired a smoke round to triangulate where I am, and I'm off a hilltop, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's for fun on the side. But as far as I know that I, in my own little world, no superhero, no great battles, and that's good because great battles cause casualties, and I just should not be a part of that. I'd like to be a part of it, but on the reverse, of course, as that relates to injured and dead soldiers, so that's all okay. So I'm very content with Jim Wheeler and how he served as a leader in Vietnam. Yes, sir.
Okay. Do you suffer any disabilities from your service?
Any disabilities?
Yes, sir.
Well, anyone who goes to war, again, especially the fighting soldier, is affected for life in one way or the other. Mm-hmm. The greatest problem that fighting soldiers bring back from war, I've read and been told, is the problem with noise, mm-hmm. and we may have already talked about that. If my albatross is noise, which it is in a great way, if that's the worst thing that I have to deal with versus those without legs, etc., then I'm doing okay. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my case, I am rated by the VA as 30% post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay.
And it isn't that I need, I don't have any of the classic, if you did the bell curve thing, and the classic of alcoholism and multiple jobs and multiple wives and all those kinds of things, spousal abuse, none of that is even, that's so far off the map removed from me that it's not even discussable, but my own is the noise problem that I didn't understand what it was until a few years ago.
Can you give me an example?
Sir?
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I definitely will, but did I not tell you about the deer in the woods thing?
I believe so.
I use that example a lot here, but the point is, until I knew that I had a problem with noise, but I just figured it was Jim Wheeler, but I didn't have it before, and when I went through the Agent Orange registry years ago and saw a psychiatrist, I basically learned part of what I've just said, that noise is a great problem, and about the only way you can deal with it is really to get away from it, because your mind is geared almost like an old 78 record, you know, grooved, that you've practiced noise discipline. And so when the noise level goes up, even though you're 30 years removed from a war, not thinking about a war, you get edgy. And so just last night I was edgy. My granddaughter was 4 years old yesterday, and our daughter took us to dinner at a wonderful, nice little restaurant, but their music was too loud. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't a play. I wasn't going to make any scenes. I don't usually make scenes. I oftentimes ask that music be turned down. Mm-hmm. But I coped with it, but I was on edge. Here I am celebrating my granddaughter's fourth birthday, but I was on edge like no one else because this noise thing affects you, and there's really no control over it because it's affecting you to a subconscious that's just there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I have a leg wound. That last wound bothers me modestly today. But it is very minor, again, in comparison to so many others. So all told, I'm in great, great shape. The noise is just something I deal with. And as I said more than once now, if that's the worst thing, then I'm good to go. I have no regrets of my only regret would be that I wasn't able to kill a little bit more of the enemy, mm-hmm. if you please. And I don't have any problem with that, and I'm a Christian man. So on a personal plane, I'm pleased with the way I performed in my time in Vietnam. Absolutely.
Is there anything that you would change about it, if you could?
Change? I don't know that there is, Richard. I took my assignments. I did them to the best of my ability.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. If I didn't, I can say that to you, but I know I did, of course. I'm very comfortable with what took place. I'm comfortable with that. I'm pleased.
Jim, what do you think the most significant thing was that you learned there?
That's an interesting question, my friend. The most... Pose it again?
The most significant thing that you learned while you were there in Vietnam. Or another way to look at that is, how has the war most affected you? What did you take from it internally?
Don't have a good, quick answer for that.
Take your time.
Unto myself, and that's probably most important, unto myself, I know that I faced up to harsh times,
mm-hmm.
and that I stood the course. I never wimped out in any way. I took it on the chin. Everything that was a part of that war scenario, I proved to myself what I already know, that I am a man,
mm-hmm.
and that I, you know, people hide behind. They got to have booze before they can go out and do this. And I've always taken everything, so to speak, figuratively speaking, on the chin. I don't hide behind anything. I'm not a 6'8" guy, but I think I probably am 6'8" mentally, in a sense, in that I fear no man. I don't hide behind any crutches.
Mm-hmm.
I am what I am, and I'm very proud of that. And I guess I proved that to myself. I guess you could say in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I just know that unto myself, I am an honest and principled person.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I stood up to it both mentally and physically.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a sidebar. I don't know how anybody, or I guess I kind of know where they wind up if they don't, but I was raised in church. And first of all, I don't know how anyone could go through life, much less a war, and not have a close relationship with our Maker.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I'd be without that, and probably I do know where I'd be, so this is okay. And then secondly, of course, I was an athlete, and loved football, could have done junior college, chose university track, and was a sprinter, you know, fast guy and all that stuff. But the point I'm making is I don't know how guys, in other words, I have those two things to fall back on, because out there in Vietnam, or even when I went to jump school, I didn't get to go to jump school until after Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
my second tour, and I went there with stitches in my legs, in my leg, and which didn't make it easy. But I reached down for that old stuff you learn in athletics, you know, and I've had those two things principally to turn to,
mm-hmm.
my spiritual strength and then my physical strength, all from my background, and I give great credit to both of those for my upbringing in the church and the strength that comes with that,
mm-hmm.
and then my interest in athletics from a little boy all the way up with the coaches and my own self doing what I did, and those are the two sources of strength that I've drew from, and still do for that matter. And I don't know how those who don't have it do it.
Okay. Would you ever want to go back to Vietnam?
I haven't had it very high on my priority list.
Mm-hmm.
primarily because there's so many other places I haven't been to, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, whereas my wife and I, you know, I was stationed in Paris, I may have mentioned before, back in the mid-60s.
Right.
I lived in downtown Paris for 2 years. So when I went back to Paris, I could walk the Champs-Élysées. I could, you know, drive through, or not even drive, but, you know, pass through the Place de l'Étoile, et cetera, et cetera. And I've been there before. And I can go back to those places. But in Vietnam, I don't think the LZ Oasis is there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I could find any. I mean, I operated where I operated the greater part of the time. I can't go back to there. So I'm not going back to something absolute. It would be more broader than that. So probably with that said, I haven't been really drawn.
Mm-hmm.
But I must say to you, that since I've come to know Dr. Varone and spoken with you, and you've caused me to think about a lot of things that I haven't thought about for years, etc., Vietnam has probably bumped itself up my little list. I can't say that it's number one yet, but I do have a greater interest of wanting to do that, even though I read and had him sign for me some years ago, Ollie North's book, when he went back. I read it. He signed it for me and all these things, but I wasn't particularly drawn. But I lean a bit more that way right now.
Okay. What do you think about Vietnam, the country, today, how it's turned out, and where it is today?
Well, I like what you said earlier, that the South still calls it Saigon. I think that's a positive, if nothing else. I have come to know a few Vietnamese. We have a restaurant that's one of our favorites that my wife and I go to, and the owner is probably 10 years my junior. So he remembers certainly the war. He took his family and did the movement through the camps, if you will, to ultimately get to the States. And so I visited with him and can appreciate what they went through immediately after, you know, in 75 and what took place. In the same manner, I now have a Vietnamese barber, believe it or not. And when I first started going to this place, I thought she was Vietnamese. I asked her and she, you know, confirmed that she was. And I said, well, golly gee, I lived 2 years in your country. Oh, when was that? And I told her, you know, 67, 8, 9, 70. She says, well, I wasn't born until 1975. And she wasn't flippant. That wasn't the point at all. She said, so I can't really appreciate, what went on before then.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the irony of that is this. And like I say, she didn't mean anything other than that was just a statement of the fact.
Mm-hmm.
But here I am, as I said to you earlier, I'm affected every day of my life just by the noise thing alone, right?
Right.
Not dramatic. I'm not trying to over... but it's, you know, I wash my car and I'm hypervigilant. I see every movement of every tree moving. When I'm out, I know I'm in my front yard, and I don't fear anything, but it is a subconscious that when I'm out there just doing my car, as the example, any movement of trees or somebody moving, I'm keenly aware of it, and the average person isn't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm affected on a daily basis, but much, much more, much less dramatically than a lot of the fellows that I deal with. Saturday night, my wife and I were, and this is a little unusual, but this is exactly what happened. My wife and I are at Billy Bob's to see Dwight Yoakam.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful show.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, I'm sitting there watching. Someone threw, I'm sure it was a girl, threw out of the dark right into the spotlight and just passed over there real quickly a flower. I'm thinking it was probably a yellow rose.
Mm-hmm.
But the way the lights hit it and the way it flashed across there, I immediately saw tracers, incoming tracers. Now, I don't, as a rule, I don't have flashbacks, you know. And I don't have those kinds of things as such. I have the hypervigilance that I just mentioned as the example in those. But so help me, I said, honey, did you see that flower? And she said, yes. And that was, and that's what she saw.
Mm-hmm.
But God is, I saw tracers. Hmm. And that's very rare for me. I don't, now, I'm not usually bothered. That wasn't a bother, but that's what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware that when there must be a very wealthy guy that lives out in the county, because I think there's a private helicopter that comes across our house every so often.
Mm-hmm.
And my neighbors just hear a little old helicopter. It doesn't sound like a Huey,
mm-hmm.
but when I hear a helicopter, my ears perk up just like that deer out there in the woods, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I perk up, and it's just another sound of daily life, but to me, it's part of my daily life back to Vietnam. We never leave the war zone. I mean, in the fullest sense.
Right.
We just don't. And that's what I see so much of in my work. Are guys though much more dramatic than what I'm speaking of, Jim Wheeler. I'm high and dry.
Talk about your work. What you do with vets today?
Well, I serve as Denton County Veterans Service Officer.
Mm-hmm.
And why I'm here is the great state of Texas. Many years ago, passed a law that says any county in Texas of a given size or greater will have a veteran service office. And so here in Denton, a very fast-growing county, we're growing by leaps and bounds. We have a very busy office. And what I serve as is I serve many roles here. I am primarily, though, a conduit between the veteran and the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The law says if you have a medical condition that was generated while wearing the uniform, whether it's a wound from war or dropping a wrench on your toe and breaking it in the motor pool,
mm-hmm.
and now you limp from it, the law says you should be compensated accordingly because you now have a shortcoming. Well, the average person doesn't give a lot to the military after they leave and don't necessarily even know that they can file a claim. And if they do know, they don't know how to go about it. So we play a little bit physician, a little bit attorney as we put together what the VA calls a well-grounded claim,
mm-hmm.
and file for that particular medical issue, be it mental, so to speak, mental from PTSD to diabetes. You know, we have about 11 issues now related to Agent Orange that are very winnable. Most everything that we file with the VA is a battle. I oftentimes talk about my putting on my flak jacket and my pot here when guys are in here, because even under the best of conditions, it's a difficult process, because the VA really and truly is going to do literally everything they can not to approve the claim. It's just a given. Now, they can't break law and do it. I'm not saying that, but they really hide behind every letter of the law.
Why is that, do you think, Jim?
Well, I'd like to think, and I think it's driven by, I don't know if you'd call it fiscal responsibility, and the example I give here oftentimes is, especially to the soldiers, I said, now the VA in this circumstance is kind of like the old supply sergeant. You know you need clean sheets or you need a new blanket, and that supply sergeant is as stingy as can be, like it's his very own personal blanket that he's got to give you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're the commander, you're pleased about that because you want accountability from your supply room. But if you're the private on the other side of the counter, or in this case, you're the veteran filing a claim, then you are very emotionally involved, and when they kick it back as a denial, you're not very pleased because they've gone down to subparagraph E, to quote some little Charlie Sierra thing that causes it to be denied, and then we have to regroup, as I say to the soldiers, okay, we're going to regroup, redistribute ammunition, and go back up the hill. And so we have to go back and get another doctor's opinion and this, that, and the other. But they are very tough, and to a certain degree it is good fiscal responsibility, but sometimes they're over the top, okay? And I've got more examples than you care to hear at this time, but I've got, for one example, I've got a military policeman who we've been in the process for PTSD now for 2 years. The last submission I gave, as Hank, my boss, found and said, I have 17 enclosures. Never heard of something so large. He says, if this doesn't win, nothing will. Well, the VA is still hiding or riding behind a law that says, in other words, if he had a Silver Star or a Purple Heart or CIB or any kind of valor award, that puts him in harm's way. But their answer, I mean, this man is consumed with PTSD. He's had an alcohol problem for years, et cetera, et cetera. I even found records when they identified he had PTSD in Waco or Temple Hospital years and years ago, which was part of my retort to them. Mm-hmm. But their answer is, hey, nothing but you, soldier, places you in harm's way. In other words, I've written back to them and I say, look, only an infantryman has a CIB. He can't have a CIB. He's not a medic, so he can't have a combat medic. Just because he wasn't wounded, not everybody gets wounded, so he doesn't have a Purple Heart. Now, I go through that little very obvious stuff. So I felt like we were going to win this last go-around just almost automatically when they read my 17 enclosures to include pictures of him on a V-100 in Vietnam, because he was his unit is a whatever the number is combat MP battalion, right? Mm-hmm. Combat is even in their title, but the VA is still saying, no, the only thing that places you in harm's way is your word. So what I just called on at status the other day, and this is after 2 years, and now they tell me they've gone to try to get the morning reports or the after-action reports of this unit buried somewhere in the archives, somewhere in the great hinterland.
Jim, let me pause you just for a moment and change out this disc. Hold
okay.
On just a second. Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
So I think you can maybe even hear my frustration here. So now the VA, armed with all that information to include their own records that said he had PTSD years ago, they've gone off to try to see if they can acquire morning reports or after-action reports from this particular MP unit. I even have a letter that a lieutenant wrote for him, but his statements carry a pretty strong impact. He even was able to find and have this lieutenant who came after this event, but the lieutenant at that time remembers the particular event and so states in his what we call a buddy statement. Mm-hmm. And even with all that, they still refuse to approve it and or disapprove it at this point, and they've gone after those reports to see if they can find an entry that says what we wrote. One of his stressors was his particular vehicle took an RPG in the right front. Well, that particular morning, because they were running behind schedule, they had filled up the left tank of fuel, mm-hmm. but didn't fill up the right front. So if they had filled up the right front like good soldiers should have done, the thing would have exploded and he'd have died and have been all done anyway. Mm-hmm. But we wrote up that event almost to the day that it happened, and now they're trying to find an after-action report to see if that's true. Hmm. So it can get very, very frustrating in those kinds of situations. But that is the greater thrust of what we do, is file claims. Now, we do a myriad of other things, you know, from ordering soldiers DD-214s mm-hmm. to helping little old widows who may be eligible for widow's pension and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. But the greater thrust of what we do are claims for compensation.
Okay, okay. You mentioned a couple of books that you had read, the SOG book and McNamara's book. Any other books that you would recommend on Vietnam or that had a particular impact upon you?
Well, I have one that's James Griffith's book called Vietnam Insights, mm-hmm. Logic of Involvement and Unconventional Perspectives. This is a book that I've read by a fellow who, this Griffith served with the 11th Army Cavalry Regiment in 68-69. He's taught high school history for more than 20 years. And it is a nice general overview of the history leading up to when we entered the war, you know, going back, you know, to the French reign, of course, mm-hmm. French Indochina, and even going back to NATO, and quite a history, quite a build-up, because one of the shortcomings that I feel from having served in Vietnam is we didn't get any kind of a really history lesson on where we were going, I mean, other than superficially.
Mm-hmm.
When those, I didn't have, you know, we all know, I guess we all know in a sense, Binh Dinh Phu took place in 54, but we didn't really know an awful lot about the country and its people.
Mm-hmm.
Both my tours, I just went there as a fresh lieutenant and went back as a captain, and there was nothing in between to, other than my own self, to learn of any of this. And again, for Jim Wheeler, I never had any language lessons. Now, there was a Vietnamese school at Biggs Army Airfield at Fort Bliss for those who were going over as advisors and stuff, I think. But the everyday soldier, not to mention me as an everyday officer, I didn't have any language, I mean, at all. So every now and then I finally, got to meet someone, wherever it was, that spoke a little French. And that's interesting that the people of today, French is lost.
Mm-hmm.
Like this barber I've mentioned as an example. Parler français means nothing to her. Well, that's a different time frame, I realize, from when the French, if you will, owned it. But
mm-hmm.
Anyway, this is a very nice book, Vietnam Insights by Griffiths.
Okay.
But SOG, far and above. Now, I've read some fictional. The 13th Valley comes to mind as one of the most enjoyable fictional books of Vietnam that I've read. 13th Valley just jumps out at me. I've read a few of those kinds of books. But far and above, SOG
mm-hmm.
is my book.
Okay.
I just adore it.
How about Vietnam movies? Do you go see them?
Have no problems with them. I've had some problems with them with the way they were presented, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But on a personal note, no. I think We Were Soldiers is just a magnificent piece of work.
Mm-hmm. What made it good?
You know, I think it just was very real. I have one of our clients is a helicopter pilot from Vietnam, three tours.
Mm-hmm.
One is gunship guy and one is a Chinook, so he saw all sides. And those are one of the guys, when you mentioned heroism, we've talked about it before, though, how I love these guys and the way they could max out those aircraft in that low-density air and haul some people out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just have the greatest respect for the helicopter pilots. And this particular pilot saw We Were Soldiers very early on and came in and told, and he walked stooped. He's 100%. He just really messed up from both shot and crashed in helicopters, I think, three times. But he praised the flying in this particular movie. It might be a subtlety to most people just looking at the movie, but he just was mightily impressed with the way the pilots worked in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so just the overall perspective of the way they presented the battle and all speaks volumes. Now, to me, Jim Wheeler, because I have been there, and I spent a lot of time in the Ai Drang, and as I've said more than once, never in anything a battle like that, thank the Lord. But what touched me more about the movie than anything was the emotions of the wives back home, because that's something I didn't get to experience.
Mm-hmm.
My wife's back home, and she's not on a base. She's just, at home living in an apartment near her mom and dad, so she didn't even have that kind of a support group either time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I was emphatically, greatly, greatly moved by all that we got to see behind the scenes with the ladies
mm-hmm.
and the battalion commander's wife, Colonel Moore's wife, taking command.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, I take exception personally that they showed, and I just want to believe with my heart and soul, that taxi guy, taxi driver delivering a death notice was just for the movie. There's no way on earth that I can comprehend that we would have taxi drivers delivering death notices. So I think, to me, my impression of that was all driven for the dramatics of the movies. Okay, and it finally got back into the hands of the wives, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But you may be able to tell me that it happened, and I accept that, but I just can't believe it. and we always have chaplains on board that, you know, personally deliver these things. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that was early in the war. It was a new concept with the 11th Air and all that kind of stuff, but I just don't, that's the one exception to the movie. The exception that I take to the movie was the mm-hmm. taxi driver delivering a death notice. I don't buy that.
What about the poorly done movies?
Well, I've probably forgotten them to a degree because over the years I've been asked on occasion that, and I always said, well, with the exception, particularly the exception of the drama of the ending of it, I thought Platoon captured it as well as any of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, anything can be taken apart, and I'm not saying it was all perfect by any means. But I thought at the very beginning when you see the FNG guy, you know, arriving all clean and crisp, and there's the bodies or the caskets fixing to be loaded on the Freedom Bird that just brought you in,
mm-hmm.
You could almost, there's that sense of smell that you've had now over there, et cetera, that's there, and you kind of feel that. So all told, I thought Platoon was the better of the bunch, and I don't consider it great, but I thought, with some exceptions, that it did all right. Full Metal Jacket comes to mind. I can't remember the titles of them all, but I've just placed over the years until now, Platoon is as close as you could get. It was I can't even call it a favorite, but it was the one that I put over the others in my own mind.
Okay. For the younger generation today, Jim, what would you tell them about the Vietnam War if you had to go into a high school classroom or a college classroom?
Well, I can speak from any number of directions. If I wasn't told that I just had an open invitation, I would go there and brag on my soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And tell them, I don't want to get into politics. I would just talk to them about the 19-year-old soldier and how well he performed in battle and how proud they should be of him. So I would take the approach of talking about the soldiers who fought the war.
Okay.
Without question.
Okay. Have you been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
You know, I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't. I've been to the moving wall,
mm-hmm.
and I said, boy, if this wall, and I've got two books right there on the wall, right in my library here, if the replica can move me this greatly, I don't know if I can handle it, so to speak, up there. Because the first time was well over 10 years ago, well over 10, when they brought it to El Paso, and it was put inside the auditorium, and my wife and I went, Dee and I, and gosh, I went in there and it was just, I'm not a weepy guy,
mm-hmm.
but it sure does it in a hurry. I mean, and this is just, if you will, the facsimile. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, they had one here at over like Memorial Day or what have you, and my son happened to be visiting, and so he and I and his mother, my wife, and I think his fiancé was with us. But in both cases, just like when I got off the planes in Hawaii to see my wife, she's such a class act. You know, there's all these people up front, da-da-da. She just stands back out of the way and so subtle and perfect and all that. And what happened here, both in the El Paso event and then at this event, my wife just, you know, backed away. And, of course, our son Trey stayed with her. And they gave me my space because you need it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an event like, I mean, I know you've talked to many, many people now, but like I say, if this facsimile can do this to you, God only knows what that wall must do. But I'm sad to say that I have not been mm-hmm. to Washington, D.C.
Okay. Well, Jim, is there anything else that you want to talk about, anything that we have not touched upon that you would like to before we wrap this up?
Gosh, I think we've run it pretty well. Needless to say, I had a life after Vietnam, a very successful
yes,
and full career.
Yes, sir.
You know, I had some great assignments all the way to Alaska, not my favorite place, but was on jump assignment in Alaska and did a lot of mountain and glacier training there and on and on. But finally in 83, chose my family over my career because I had been a below the zone of promotion, so I was certainly geared toward what I wanted to be was a general officer, and I know that I could have been that, but at the same time, I reached a point where I just said, I don't choose. If I choose to make 06, then I'm choosing to leave my family for a year and to Korea, and I choose not to do that. I just don't want to do that at this point in my life, and that was a very good decision. I mean, some days, not every now and then, I got that little twist in the stomach that says, doggone, you could have been at least a one-star retired, and that would have been nice, but bottom line is, I made a good decision. I got to keep our girls home throughout their college careers, which I wouldn't have done otherwise. I'd have dropped them off along the way like so many have. And that would have worked. I've got the greatest military wife that ever lived, and it would have all worked. But bottom line is, I kept my babies much longer than otherwise, and that's okay. Yeah. So it was a good run for this little old Tennessee country boy. Believe me.
Okay. Well, Jim, thank you very much for your time. I very much appreciate it. And we'll go ahead and end the oral history interview with James Wheeler, Jr. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Richard.